Welcome to this week's Key Voices. I'm Richard Skipper, bringing you a roundup of the latest education news and an interview with our special guests, Laura Tomkinson and Joy Corner from the ICO. In the news this week, parents want outstanding schools inspected more often, according to results of Ofsted's annual parent survey. The survey also found that most parents think the majority of subjects aren't given enough time in the curriculum, and two-thirds think Ofsted helps raise standards. The government will tighten schools' accountability around exclusions. This was revealed by the Academy's Minister, Lord Agnew, at the Education Select Committee. He also said the cost of the Department for Education's school resource management advisors has almost doubled to £4 million. The Department for Education Minister has said he is concerned at the lack of awareness about new guidance and how schools should deal with incidents of peer-on-peer sexual abuse. In a letter to the Labour MP Emma Hardy, Naheem Zahawi, the Children and Families Minister, admitted that the DfE had to do further work to raise awareness about the advice. Also this week, the BBC has reported on the draft of the new Welsh National Curriculum being unveiled. The Education Minister said that the new curriculum will be a big culture change and very different to what most of us will have experienced. It will be introduced in 2022 for all children currently in year 3 or below. Almost a third of teachers spend at least a working week of their Easter break on their jobs, a Snap poll has suggested. The survey by TES shows that 30% of those polled spent between 5 and 9 days during their job over the holidays, and another 2% worked at least 10 days of a holiday. Head teachers in England have been told to endure the darkest hour until the Treasury spending plans for future school funding are revealed. Nick Gibb, the Schools Minister for England, hinted at an end to austerity when the details of the next spending round are announced in autumn. And now on to our interview series. This week we are speaking to Laura Tomkinson and Joy Corner. They are team managers for data protection at the ICO. Welcome to the podcast. So my first question to you is, we're coming up on a year since the GDPR came into place. What would you expect for schools to be at this point in terms of their journey towards GDPR compliance?
Well, we would expect that they have done what they need to do in order to comply at this point. It's been a year since it's been implemented now, so we would expect that we're at a sort of level of compliance across the board, not just for schools, but for all organisations. Some of the things that would be key on that would be to be familiar with the requirements of GDPR, so using our website and other resources to keep up to date with that, to have mapped their data, so to understand what they hold, where, how long for. You've just shown us the information audit tool that Key Support offers, and that's a really good way of using that tool to help you make sure that you know what data you hold and that kind of thing. You should have established your lawful basis for processing, so know how you're handling information legally. Revise any policy and procedures for retention or your privacy policy, your policies for your subject access requests, requests for erasure, those sorts of things. Make sure your staff are all up to date, have all their training, and it's repeated frequently. Appointed a DPO if required. So obviously that's a public sector requirement, so not necessarily for private schools, but if you need one, make sure you've got one. And also be in the habit of carrying out data protection impact assessments for any processing that might prevent risks. And if you're not sure, check our website.
Good to hear. So that kind of leads me on to the next question. If we're talking about things that they should be doing at this point, what are some of the common misconceptions about the GDPR you've seen in schools? What are things that you think people aren't quite understanding or might be misled on?
Right. There seems to be an overemphasis on consent. People seem to think that an organisation has to have their consent in order to process their personal data. They need to look at other bases for processing when they're sharing data, for example. There may well be a legal obligation to share it. We also see that schools, and this hasn't changed since GDPR, using the legislation to unnecessarily restrict activities like letting parents record sports days and concerts and things like that. It would be good practice to say that parents can film, but they mustn't share the information on the internet. The data protection framework doesn't prevent parents from recording their children for their own personal use for domestic purposes. Coming on to the common themes we see in complaints, and these are very similar to the complaints we received pre-GDPR. Subject access requests are the biggest cause of complaints to us. Schools don't always recognise subject access requests. They need to bear in mind that the requester doesn't have to say it's a subject access request or refer to the legislation, although that's always helpful if they do. If it's a request for personal data, then it should be treated as a subject access request. Sometimes they'll refuse a subject access request because it's for too much information. They treat subject access requests as FOI requests. It's important to distinguish whether the requester is asking for their own or the child's personal data, or whether it's for official information. Thinking that governor's personal work email accounts don't have to be searched for personal data. They do. We recommend that governors should always use a school official school email address for any school business. In relation to data protection officers, sometimes they don't give us the contact details, which they need to do, and they can do via our website. Not recognising requests for erasure. And in terms of security, things like leaving papers unattended in reception, leaving a screen unlocked so that anyone can view the information on it. And some schools still don't have a privacy policy on their website, and that's really important to comply with the right to be informed.
Okay, great. That all sounds really helpful. So in terms of your role in this, the role of the ICO, will the ICO be doing anything to make sure schools are compliant? Are there kind of any sort of plans for routine inspections of schools?
Not so much routine inspections of schools. We do have an assurance department, and they look at auditing organisations. We have been doing some audits with schools as part of a sort of wider picture of all the different kinds of organisations that we audit. So not necessarily checking up on schools, making sure they're doing it right, but we do try and cover all the different sectors and make sure we have kind of an overview of, sorry, of what's going on. We have sort of different channels of getting messages out. We've got a dedicated policy department area that focuses on education and schools, and I know that they do a lot of work going out to conferences with different wider bodies, sometimes through legal sort of, I think there's some solicitors firms that sort of set up businesses that help out with information requests and things like that. Whenever we receive a complaint in to the ICO in the complaints department about a school, if there is a way that we can help them improve their practices, that's our main priority. We're here to try and help them improve and get better. So if we see that there's something missing, that they haven't got a privacy policy, for example, like Joy said, or if they haven't handled a subject access request in the best way, we'll try and give them hints and tips as to how they can improve that and what processes they should put in place to help them to not fall into these traps in the future. So nothing sort of specifically targeted at schools, but the way we deal with schools is, especially smaller schools, we are quite sensitive to the to the fact that data protection is not your business, education is your business, and sometimes data protection gets pulled into it. So we do try and support them as much as possible when we're dealing with them.
Okay. So moving on to my next question, something that we've had a lot of questions about is kind of what the sort of expectations are in terms of security arrangements you would expect to see in schools. And also in sort of situations such as if a staff member is taking work home with them, like an exercise book, or if they're taking information with them on a school trip. What are the kind of expectations there from the ICO?
Well, security is one of the most important things. And as with any organisation, they need to have appropriate technical and organisational arrangements in place to protect the data. Particularly relevant to schools, we think restricting access to personal data, whether it's held electronically or in paper form, particularly things like SEN records, anything to do with child protection or safeguarding, and CCTV footage. Looking at the kind of apps that a lot of schools use now, they need to be careful about what they're selecting to be used for online homework or communication with parents. For example, parent payment apps. It's the school's responsibility to ensure compliance. They can't rely on the app to do that. Keeping parents and children's information, including contact details, secure, particularly where there's a sensitive issue like cases of domestic abuse or where there are court orders. Anonymising information presented at governors or trust board meetings, making sure forms, documents and exam scripts are not visible to students, making sure emails to staff from colleagues or parents don't appear on smart boards during lessons. And very important, to avoid discussing students in front of other students or parents or staff. In terms of personal data taken home by staff or on school trips, we think school trips are likely to include carrying special category data like health information about the students, and they need to be especially careful about that. They should only be taking personal data out of school if it's really necessary. And particularly with paper files, we'd say avoid that wherever possible. If you do have to take paper files out, you need to be recording what you're taking and then checking it back in when you bring it back to the school. So you should have some sort of an asset register for that. And take proportionate measures to protect the information. Don't leave your bag on the bus, things like that. It's obvious, but it happens. You should also make sure there's a backup copy at school just in case the worst scenario does occur. Leaving loose files or laptops or anything like that in vehicles is obviously a no-no. And information on mobile devices should only be accessed via secure passwords. We think schools should have a policy on bring your own devices, and they should only use their own mobiles to call parents if it's a necessity. And they should delete the parents' number afterwards. And probably most importantly, we discourage the use of USB sticks because they're so easily lost. But if you do use them, the files on there should be encrypted, and that also applies to files on laptops and tablets that are taken out of school.
Okay, great. That's all really helpful. It's a nice set out of those expectations there. So I guess following on from that, I guess the question would be, in the case that those security arrangements didn't work or there's some sort of issue there, how would the ICO respond to a data breach that a school reports to you? Does the response depend on the significance of the breach?
It definitely does. The requirement to report a breach to the ICO is not for every single instance of a personal data breach. It has to meet the sort of criteria, which is there being a risk to the freedoms and rights of the person whose information has been lost. In terms of how we respond, it's not different for a school as it is for any other organisation, and we look at each sort of breach on a case-by-case basis. If we think that there's sort of a very low risk, that the school has mitigated that risk, so an email maybe has been sent without the BCC function, that might be an example of something that could be reported. If the school has sort of taken steps to retrieve the information that's been sent out to the wrong person and has, you know, sort of said that they're going to train the staff and taken steps to improve things that way, we're probably less likely to take that further. Obviously, if you're stepping up, if it's someone's details of someone having been adopted and that's gone out, we're going to look at that more seriously. Some of the things that you might want to consider when you're reporting a personal data breach is the 72-hour time frame. So obviously, with a school being open Monday to Friday, if something happens on a Friday, you really need to deal with that as soon as possible. And that's the same when it comes with being close to school holidays. If, for example, you report a breach quite close to a holiday, it's worth trying to think about the contact person that you give to us, so that if we need to contact you, you're available. So if you're about to go on 6 weeks of leave and you're not going to be the person that's in the office, please can you give us the name of somebody who will be available? Schools may also have sort of less experience at dealing with breaches than other controllers, so we'd always recommend ringing the helpline. We've got a dedicated personal data breach helpline, and if you're unsure whether it meets the threshold or not, or the best thing to do is just give the helpline a call and they'll be able to answer your questions and help you to report it if you need to. We've also got a self-assessment tool on the website, which will help you if you need to help you to decide if you need to report that breach. So it might seem a bit scary at first, but we've got a lot of tools out there to help you to report the right kind of breaches to us. When the personal data breach team receives a notification of a breach, one of the things, they'll consider a lot of things when they're looking at it. They'll take into consideration what happened, when and how the controller or the ICO became aware of it, the actual or potential risks to the data subjects. When we were talking before about BCC emails versus adoption information, obviously the risks to data subjects are massively different in those cases, and we'll take that into account. The number of individuals affected, so is it one family, is it an entire class of people, is it the entire school, the measures that have been taken to help people affected. So often we're looking at cases where there's been a hacking incident. So if your servers have been hacked or something like that, if you're taking measures to advise the people who that might have affected, how to contact Action Fraud and those sorts of things, we'll take that into account. Just simply how the breach occurred. Is it a sort of human error incident, or do you have some inherent issues with systems, or is it something that's happened before? Were there any measures in place that could have prevented it but just didn't? And whether you've considered how you can stop that breach in future. So like I said before, if you've taken steps to mitigate that risk at the time, if we can see that when we're assessing it, they're the kind of things that we take into account. I mean, as our commissioner always says, fines are our last option. So we will look at all the different ways that we can help you to improve your practices before we go down that strong-handed route. So really, like I said before, if you can get in touch with us, if you have any questions, ring the helpline and we'll help you to decide whether it is one of the breaches that we'll need to see and to get that reported to us as soon as you can.
Great. So my next question, this is one that we've seen coming in a lot from members, is that under the terms of the GDPR, we know that you should retain data for no longer than necessary. That's the term it uses. So we just kind of wanted to know, are there any sort of guidelines on how to determine whether it is necessary to hold a piece of data for any longer?
Well, for schools, the starting point's always going to be whether they're obliged to retain the information under particular legislation. So if there's a statutory requirement to retain it, obviously that will cover anything. Things like child protection records and SEN records will have a statutory retention period. Then it becomes more difficult what's longer than necessary. Things like job applications, unless there's a clear business reason to retain them, don't keep records for unsuccessful applicants beyond the statutory period when a claim could arise from it. When an employee leaves, you should retain enough information to be able to provide references, for example, but delete personal data that you're unlikely to need again, like the personal contact details, emergency contact details. You should be reviewing all the personal data that you're holding from time to time to check if you still need it or whether the time frames have changed. And probably most importantly is to have an email retention policy. We're all guilty of keeping emails for longer than we really need to. You shouldn't be retaining emails forever. And schools often find when they get a subject access request that makes them think about the retention policy for emails because they've had to trawl through months, if not years, of emails to find the information that's been requested. So you definitely have an email retention policy. That's, again, it's going to be different for different types of data, and it's impossible to provide you with a definition for how long is necessary. It all depends on the different circumstances. But what we do recommend is that you have a responsible person, a data protection coordinator perhaps, who you can go to and get some advice on how long you should be retaining certain information, and that person can then check for compliance with the policy periodically as well.
Yeah, I mean, one of the ways you can sort of set up your policy is literally thinking, how long do I have a legitimate business need to hold this information for? If you're going through your files and you're thinking, why have I got that? You don't need it. So it's kind of thinking about things in that sense. There's no point holding on to information just in case. If you can't easily think of a legitimate business need to hold that information, you probably don't need it. So that's, we can't really give like a hard and fast, it's X number of years for this information or Y number of months for that information. But, you know, that's the way that we sort of always advise people to think about it, is thinking about your business needs and how you can justify it, base it on sort of statutory guidance where you can, or legislative requirements if you need to. And then just weighing up what's useful for, it's always shorter for emails. You know, 6 months is probably a fair guess for emails. You might have different emails that you might need to keep, but maybe take them out of your inbox, store them somewhere else, have them in the appropriate file. I think if you've kind of having an awareness of what you hold, holding it in the right place, that's also really important.
Okay, so kind of related to that point, and we were talking about these earlier, but one of the other big questions I would say we get asked a lot is about dealing with subject access requests. So the question I have is, how should schools be dealing with subject access requests in a way that's time efficient and cost efficient as well?
It kind of perfectly leads on from the retention sort of situation. The cases we see in the complaints department where their schools are struggling to comply because of the sheer volume of information, that's exactly part of the problem, because it is, yes. there's often a reluctance to remove and delete information. We'll get ex-parents whose children haven't been at a school for a long time complaining about that school, and they've still got emails going back to the beginning of time almost, and that's probably not going to help at all. If you've got a tight retention policy and you stick to it, then that's going to automatically make it easier to deal with these kind of sort of subject access requests that might or could be time and cost sort of issues. The other ways that you can kind of sort of streamline your process, I suppose is the best way to say it, is have a policy and a procedure in place and ensure that staff know about it and are trained. So make sure that all your staff, so your teachers, your support staff, everybody recognises a SAR. They can be made verbally now, so you know all the staff in the school need to be aware that if somebody asks them for their personal information, that counts. So it's just making sure that everyone's aware of the process that's in place. I mean, it depends on the size of the organisation, the size of the school, but it can be helpful if you're slightly bigger to have some kind of tracking system. So nothing fancier than a spreadsheet, really, but just a record of when the SAR came in, how long you've got to comply with it, who you've asked, what the deadlines are. And if you keep that up to date, then that's going to help you to be more streamlined. If you record on that also what you sent out and when you've sent it out, if you then get repeat requests, you can be confident when you can say, we've provided you with this already. Because we see that quite often. Someone might come back and say, I haven't had this, I haven't had that. The school thinks, oh, I think I've sent it to you, but can't prove it. So if you have if you keep your records quite tight and you're recording what you're sending out, then that helps you in the long sort of down the line if you get sort of repeat persistent requesters. What else can we say? Again, the point about trust governors and trust board members using school email addresses, that will help you sort of keep it quick. And if you've got access to those email systems, you can do that remotely if necessary. You don't have to go out and ask individuals who may not be available or maybe on holiday. We would always recommend sending copies of personal data electronically. That's going to be a quicker way to do it, a cheaper way to do it as well. You don't have to send paper copies unless they're specifically requesting that. So try and stick to electronic copies where possible. And again, you don't have to send whole documents. So if there's only a small amount of personal data contained within that file or within that document, you can either redact it or send extracts. And one of the things that I think schools sometimes worry about in terms of taking time is the time it takes to redact third-party information. So we would always say that you need to be really sensible when you're redacting third-party information. Just because it's the name of another individual doesn't necessarily mean it would be unreasonable to contain it within that SAR. If it's a meeting that both parties were present at, it doesn't make sense to remove that third party's information if they were both there and a part of that meeting. So it's kind of being a bit more sensible and just thinking about, well, what's reasonable for that person to have access to. And that can help you save time, because if you're not going through and redacting every third instance where that other person's name is mentioned, that might be a quick way to do things. And then again, at the end, you know, read our guidance on the website. I think we're issuing new subject access guidance soon, so that should help in terms of hints and tips as to how to do SARs. And if you're still not sure, contact our helpline and they should be able to point you in the right direction.
Okay. So we've talked now about things that are happening at the moment. So kind of for the last two questions, I thought we should look at things that might happen in the future. So the first one, it's kind of a big issue, obviously, and it applies to data protection as well. So in the event of Brexit, what should schools be doing to prepare in terms of data protection arrangements, particularly if they're making any sort of international transfers, like if they hold data in a server that's somewhere in Europe, for example?
Okay, well, to start with, again, referring to our website, to prepare for the possibility of a no-deal Brexit, there is a checklist that they need to have a look at. But we would say the best preparation for Brexit is to ensure that you're effectively complying with the GDPR now. the government plans to incorporate the GDPR into UK law when we leave. For transfers into the UK, review your data flows and identify where you receive data into the UK from the EEA, and think about what GDPR safeguards you can put in place to ensure that the data can continue to flow once we're outside the EU. Transfers from the UK, identify first of all where the school transfers data from the UK to any country outside the UK, as these are going to fall under new UK transfer and documentation provisions once we leave. And review privacy information and internal documentation to identify any details that will need updating when the UK leaves the EU. And again, all we can say to you is keep checking our guidance for the most up-to-date information. We're all a little bit in the dark about what's going to happen when at the moment. So keep checking the website.
Okay. Yeah. So that leads us nicely on to my final question, is what's next for the GDPR? So should schools be looking out for any sort of further developments in data protection law or any sort of further guidance from you? You've mentioned a couple of things so far, but is there anything else you can talk about?
So I think the big one is the new subject access code of practice that will kind of incorporate all the advice that we had previously under the DPA 98. A lot of it hasn't changed, but there are some new parts, some nuances, and that'll be covered in those. So that should be a really good, helpful tool for all the organisations that deal with requests for information. Like we said earlier, we do realise that schools' business is education, and that there are loads of demands on schools' times, and we're very keen to engage with them and support them. So it kind of, if you have any questions, I keep saying it, but like if our website is really helpful and the helpline are more than happy to sort of support and help. We're trying to look at the opportunities that we have to engage with schools where they're already kind of getting together. So like we're saying about conferences before and that kind of thing, like we are looking for engagement opportunities. But in terms of changes to the GDPR, what's next for the GDPR? It is what we've got now. So it's nothing's massive is changing. We're just sort of consolidating our understanding of it with the practices that we're seeing from organisations when we deal with complaints, and just really it's not going to change massively now. Even if we were to leave, or when Brexit does happen, it's still going to be that same piece of legislation really. So I think we've had it for big changes for now.
I think one of the things I'd like to say to finish off, though, is sometimes schools are afraid of what we might do if a complaint comes to us. They see all the headlines about the monetary penalties we've issued. We'd like to get across to them that we are here to help primarily. We want them to get it right.
Yeah. It's, you know, ultimately, at the end of the day, the people, the pupils, the parents, teachers, they're like your customers, if you like. It's your responsibility to be processing their data securely and in line with all the other provisions of the GDPR. And you're, you know, as a school, as a data controller, you're accountable for that. So we just ask that you are accountable for the decisions that you make. If someone isn't happy about that and they come to us, that's kind of what we're looking for, really, just to help. Mm. If you're unsure as to how you to handle something, or you might have got something wrong, we will try and guide you down the path of getting it right. And resolving the matter between you and the individual.
I think that's everything then. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. Thank you very much for listening. Key Voices is produced by The Key, giving education leaders the knowledge to act. Special thanks to Laura and Joy for talking to us today. Members of The Key for School Leaders can access hundreds of articles on the latest issues in education at thekeysupport.com.